to the American Revolution podcast, episode 37, The Early War in the South. So, friends, we've been spending several weeks on the early part of 1776 because there's just so much going on. Remember back before the start of the new year, we were talking about the siege of Quebec. Well, that's still going on as far as the timeline is concerned, only a few months before it's going to be lifted. In the Boston area, Henry Knox is still bringing the Noble Artillery train from Fort Ticonderoga to Washington's camp in Cambridge. It hasn't been easy for the British. They thought that they were just going to steamroll the Americans. They were nothing but farmers with pitchforks. They were going to put down the rebellion quickly, and everything would go back hunky-dory between her colonies and the Isle of Great Britain. But now we're approaching a year into the conflict, and things are just not looking great for the British. They have two whole armies under siege, one in Canada, one in Boston, and little support from the provincials, at least in the north. At the start of the conflict, the loyal governors of the South, the colonies of Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, tell the British that if they came and sailed to the southern ports, that they would have the overwhelming support of the loyalists in the area. Now, in early 1776, the British are going to have to take up the southern governors on that offer. Henry Clinton will sail from Britain with a small fleet of ships and head south. The first ships will arrive off Tybee Island at the mouth of the Savannah River on January 12, 1776. The arrival of the British fleet prompted a Patriot response. They prepared for a defense against the British invasion. They even went so far as to capture the Royal Governor James Wright, who was part of the reason why the British fleet was here in the first place. They place him under house arrest. He will escape and will be evacuated by the British to Nova Scotia. Clinton will move the fleet up the river to Hutchinson Island, which is on the river right by Savannah Port. They land there and capture 10 boats that were loaded with rice. This would be good to help the besieged British in Boston. Once again, the Patriots muster and prepare for the defense. They place a cannon on the cliffs overlooking the island. They also go upriver and set boats on fire, sending them downriver, hoping that they would catch the British ships on fire. They do succeed in setting one of the captured supply boats ablaze, but that's about it. Now, we're going to talk more about these fire ships when we talk about the defense of the Hudson, but just so that you have a basic knowledge of what they are, they're pretty much just a small boat that basically you put all kinds of flammable materials in, rope, pitch, cotton, anything you can get your hands on that will burn. And now the trick is that you send it downriver and you hope that you can hook it onto a British ship. And what happens is when it gets hooked onto the British ship, it starts to set the ship itself on fire. That's the prospect of it. We're going to talk about how successful these fire ships were. But just know that they were able to light one of the supply boats on fire. Everything that I've gathered, though, was that supply boat was actually empty, so they pretty much did nothing of any consequence with the fire boats. But it was pretty obvious to Clinton that he was going to have to choose a new port. Savannah maybe isn't going to be the best place to try and land. He's also starting to get it in the back of his head that maybe the South isn't so rife with loyalist sentiment as he was told. The next move for the British is to sail for Cape Fear. In North Carolina, the Royal Governor Josiah Martin, like Wright, calls for the loyalists to rally to the Union Jack. And like Wright, he is also exiled by the Patriots. But the word is out. The local militia is to rally at Brunswick near Wilmington Port, where they could rendezvous with Clinton's force. Martin had hoped when he put out this order that a good amount of Highland Scots that were living in the area would turn out for the call. And he was right. Scots were settling in the area after the French and Indian War, and their loyalty to the crown still held true. So by mid-February, over 1,600 loyal Highland Scots assembled at Cross Creek under the command of Brigadier General Donald MacDonald, a French and Indian War veteran. From there, they would march to Brunswick. The Patriots, of course, were not going to let them just pass unopposed. Colonel James Moore and about 1,000 of his patriots set out to try and block McDonald's path. This began to cause a bit of a cat-and-mouse game. As McDonald moved towards Brunswick, Moore would find a way to block his path, and he would have to adjust or remove the barrier. So McDonald is heading for the Moore's Creek Bridge. That's going to be his best crossing point. He's not far from Brunswick at this point, and even closer to meeting up with Clinton and his force. Moore has to face McDonald. He orders two of his colonels, Richard Caswell and Alexander Lillington, to set a defense at the bridge. Caswell and Lillington have about 950 men and two cannon that they affectionately named Old Mother Covington and her daughter. Caswell took about 800 men and set a prepared defensive position on the west side of the bridge, while Lillington took another 150 and the two cannon and manned a hill on the east side of the bridge. It was a pretty stout defense, and as some of McDonald's scouts closed, they report back to the Brigadier General about the situation. McDonald has to convene a council of war. The council decides that they're going to have to attack on the early morning of the 26th. McDonald, who's been sick, is not able to lead the attack, so it falls to his second-in-command, Lieutenant Colonel McLeod. He would have the complete force, about 1,600 men. The only problem was 500 had flintlocks, the rest had broadswords. McLeod feels that 1 a.m. is the best time to attack. If he attacks in the middle of the night, maybe he can catch the Patriots off guard. So McLeod leads the Scots to the bridge. As they approach, they came upon trenches, Caswell's position. His men move into them. But Caswell had moved to the east side. There's no one in the position. So McLeod now has to cross the bridge to the east side and face the combined force of Caswell and Lillington. The only problem is, Caswell, to make sure that they even had a better defense, pulled up all the boards on the bridge. And to make matters worse, they greased the frame so that it would be very slow moving for McLeod to move to the other side of the river. But he has his orders. He has to get this army across that bridge in the best way possible so that they can meet up with Clinton and his army. The Scots are moving across the bridge as best they can. The greased up frame is making it very difficult for them to move. By the time they get about halfway across the bridge, the Patriots on the east side open up in a tremendous fire. They open up with musket and grapeshot. 70 are killed and wounded in the first volley, including McLeod, who was hit over 30 times. Yes, 30 times. The Loyalists don't stop or even try and put up an offensive. They turn right around and retreat. The Patriots, moving from their position, give chase and over a couple of days are able to round up about 850 of the Loyalists, including McDonald, who was still in his tent at the rear of the line. Clinton hears about the tragedy at Moore's Creek Bridge and is, well, shocked. The South is not being as supportive as he was made to believe. He wants to try and open a third front to relieve the pressure of Boston and Canada and try and free up those armies there. Clinton has one more chance. He's hoping that the largest port in the South will prove an easier nut to crack than Savannah or North Carolina. Next week, we're going to talk about the Battle of Sullivan's Island and whether that was going to be the deciding factor of what would happen in the South with Clinton and his army. So that's going to do it for this week. It was a short episode this week, just because this is one of those little, I want to say footnote stories of history. It's key to for people to realize that while we have offensives in the South as early as 1776, you really see how the mood changes, at least politically, in favor of patriotism. Now, Georgia is going to be a very difficult talking point because they're very back and forth. The Deep South is a tough area to understand the thinking when it comes to who they're supporting. South Carolina is going to be very much on the fence, and we're going to talk more about them when we get to talking about the Declaration of Independence and how they feel about the matter. North Carolina, as I said, after Moore's Creek Bridge and, you know, Clinton leaving Cape Fear, it's very pro-patriotic. There's no royal authority left there. Josiah Martin has been exiled. There's no one there in North Carolina that is going to support the crown. They capture their best hope with the Highland Scots. And the fact that Dunmore in Virginia was still preaching that the South would rise in favor of the crown, especially in Virginia, well, he is just delusional. There's never an attempt to bring Virginia into the Loyalist fold. The governing body there, the House of Burgess, was sternly in the camp of we want independence. But that's something we'll also talk about when we start talking about the Declaration of Independence. So that does it for this week. Next week, tune in for the Battle of Sullivan's Island, one of the largest southern offensives in the early part of the war. Till then, always remember, keep your powder dry.